Political party takes power. Meanwhile, the Jewish soldier, ex-barber, veteran of the World War, suffered a loss of memory and remained an inmate of the soldiers' hospital for many years. He was ignorant of the profound change that had come over Tomania. Hinkle the dictator ruled the nation with an iron fist. Under the new emblem of the double cross, liberty was banished. Free speech was suppressed, and only the voice of Hinkle was heard.
Hey, der Strafnitz Hilfensekt! Der Wiener Schnitzel mit der Lagerwirten und der Saukraut! Hey, der Flüten sagt der Flerten! Ein Tomania wie ein Straff! Und der Blitzen sagt der Klütz! Hey, ich bleibe noch Straff mit der Ach!
Balone!
Balone, was ein Stritz mit seinen Eltern sagt der Hüten! Ein der Straff mit seiner Klütz! Hey, der Stratz mit sich Gedanken da! Mit seiner Tratz mit sich Gedanken! Meine eine Tita, wie das Straffen! Die Straffen! Sie Straffen!
Adenoid Hinkle has just said, yesterday Tomania was down, but today she has risen.
I love how you're just being stared down this whole time by this cat. Like, done?
Yeah. Are we done here, dude? So I'm going to throw you for six, and I'm just going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Awards Don't Matter. On this particular episode, my name, Andrew Pierce. I'm joined by Dave. We're going to be discussing Charlie Chaplin films. usually, now see, Dave's got this thing. He's like, if you start with a good day, that means that it's good film.
No, it just means you're excited. You've got energy. That's all it means. I love that you started this episode with, like, on this episode, my name is Andrew Pierce, as if it would be different on another episode. I like that. I like the mystery involved. It's good. It's all very good.
Yeah. Yeah. So welcome, Dave. Thanks for joining me to discuss Comedy Hitler. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Comedy's about Hitler. I think that's exactly what I posted. Like, thanks to Andrew, I'm watching a comedy about Hitler. I think there's only one or two of those, right? There can't be that many comedies about Hitler. Like, Hitler shows up in comedies as a source of mockery, but this is, like, about Hitler, like, very clearly. So it's a little bit different.
Even though his name isn't mentioned at all. But, yeah, this is The Great Dictator. And part of the reason why we're discussing it is because Charlie Chaplin, as great a director and actor and person, well, not less so a person, you know, just like Hitchcock, he had his own problems as well. But as an actor and a director, he really is quite a powerful person in film history. And yet he didn't have that many, you know, dalliances, I guess, with the Oscars. This is his Best Picture nominated mm-hmm. film here. He wasn't nominated for Best Director, but he was also nominated for Best Actor here. And this is effectively, you know, obviously this came out in 1940. And it's pretty impressive that he managed to write a film that feels so pointedly aware of the future and aware of what is to come. Because this is a political satire film about a guy, a Jewish private soldier who doesn't have a name, but he effectively saves another soldier, and they have a fate that is kind of entwined in some ways, but that's not really the main plot. This Jewish soldier, 20 years after World War One, ends up back in kind of this town, in this ghetto with a whole bunch of other Jewish people, and meanwhile, there is a tyrannical terrible dictator called Adenoid Hinkle, which is a fantastic name, also played by Chaplin, and he is effectively Hitler, and you know, the two kind of look the same, and that's part of the comedy of this particular film. This is my first watch for this particular film. Was it your first watch as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's the only thing I knew about it going in was, one, that it was a satire about Hitler, and then I'd heard that the final speech in the movie is, like, kind of one for the record books. Like, that's the thing that people really pull from this. But it's also, like, I mean, you know, not that we should be surprised because it's Charlie Chaplin, but, man, this movie's really fucking funny. Like laugh out loud bits here. And one of the things I thought of as I was watching this is, like, man, Mel Brooks must love this movie. Like, there's so many bits in here that I'm like, oh, I could see Mel Brooks doing this exact thing in one of his movies. And I find it interesting that we I think over the years have denigrated comedy and don't take it. It sounds weird to say, but don't take it seriously when it comes to awards, when it comes to stuff like this. But if you mention the name Charlie Chaplin, people are like, oh, Charlie Chaplin. Yes, that's very, very good. Very, very amazing filmmaker. But then you know, mention a filmmaker like Mel Brooks, like, oh, very silly. You know, we don't have to really pay attention to the lessons in his movies. But Chaplin, maybe because of how old it is and because it started in silent film era. And that was one thing that I actually, as I started this, I didn't do any research on it. And I had no idea whether this was like a silent film or not, because I'd heard The Last Monologue is important, but like I'd never heard it. So I was like, how does that work? Because I think of Charlie Chaplin, I think of silent film. So for this not to be that was kind of a shock to the system as I started to watch it, but you adjust very quickly. And it's so impressive that because silent film is a very different art form than the talkies. Like, it's just a whole different stylistic choice with acting, with directing, with framing, all that stuff. And he just like, you know, he's just kind of a master at all of it. Like,
yeah, he effortlessly blends the two. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, because that first sequence in the plane where they're upside down with the water is gold. It's so funny. Like, it doesn't overstay its welcome. It does, like, just enough, and then you end the bit. But that felt like silent film stuff, right? But then, you know, you have, you know, the flirtation between the male and female lead characters. You've got, of course, the monologue at the end and the discussions between the leaders, which is, like, brilliant. Brilliant voice acting stuff. And doesn't ever really suffer from feeling like, oh yeah, he's definitely a silent film actor. Like, he's just got such presence in this movie that you never really think about that.
Yeah, exactly. And he, as I said, he blends the two together perfectly. Those opening sequences are really quite fascinating and hilarious as well. But it also, you know, as he cements his life back in normalcy in the ghetto where he is a barber, and you know, the moments where he tries to give people haircuts and stuff like that are quite amusing. And you know, you may cringe.
He tries to give her a shave.
Yeah,
that's a great moment.
Yeah,
and I really love that moment, because it could have been played for like buffoonery, but I love the fact that they both take a pause and then they both laugh together. It's such a sweet, sweet moment, you know, like, and all that stuff really, really works.
It is quite charming in that regard. And of course, you know, I'm loath to bring it up, but it's clear, we mentioned in the last episode, the impact of Rebecca on Guillermo del Toro, but, you know, the impact of a film like The Great Dictator, that kind of sequence is clearly a homage in Paddington 2 out of all films. Like, I'm sorry to bring it up, but it's like, there disgusting. Are moments, you know, just like in Modern Times and stuff like that, there is that kind of impactful comedy that is there. And you know, I'm reading news this morning that Seth Rogen, is his next film is going to be inspired by Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and stuff like that, and focusing more on the physical hijinks and things, because there is there's an artistry to that. There's a comedy that is, it feels like a pratfall, because it is a pratfall, but also as well, it is falling with style. It's graceful. You know, it's balletic in a way. And,
right,
you know, Chaplin manages to carry that across these two characters that he plays so perfectly. And specifically, there's a moment here where it's the one scene that I had seen from The Great Dictator before, in a capsule in a way, where effectively Hinkle, in this really quite beautiful and charming, sweet little moment, is kicking and bouncing a globe, you know, and in that moment, you think it's quite sweet and charming. But then when you think about it as well, you know, you have a dictator who is literally playing around and kicking the world like it's a toy. Yeah,
it's a megalomaniac. Yep. Like, it's a comedic,
like, it's nothing.
Symbolic version of that. It's incredible. I think probably my favorite recurring bit in this movie is him going in to have his portrait painted.
Yep.
And he always gives up like 9 seconds, and then he's out the door. These guys are always like, God damn it.
Yeah.
Again, like, it's amazing. There's so many good bits. And I think, when I was watching the movie and thought of Mel Brooks was the scene where the Mussolini character, I think his name is Benzino Napolini, which is not real far from Mussolini, his arrival and them like essentially bringing out the red carpet, and it keeps going too far and they keep running back and forth to try and get this decorum right. Like, that stuff really, really works for me. And this movie is proof that you can satirize some of the most evil men in history and have it take the piss out of them and not pump them up in any way.
At all cost, Napoleon shall not invade Austerlitz. That country belongs to me.
At this meeting, we shall not discuss the Austerlitz situation. This interview is solely to impress upon him the force of your personality. To make him feel your superiority.
Here.
This man, Napoleon, is aggressive, domineering. Before we make our demands, we must put him in his place.
Precisely, but how?
By means of applied psychology. In other words, by making him feel inferior. This can be done in many subtle ways. For instance, at this interview, I have so arranged it that he will always be looking up at you. You looking down at him. At all times, his position will be inferior.
Excellent.
Then again, we shall seat him here, beside your bust, so that if you relax, that will always be glaring at him.
Huh? Oh. Where is he now?
Resting. When he arrives, I have arranged that he shall enter from the far end of the room. Another psychological triumph. He will have the embarrassment of walking the entire length of the floor toward you.
Very good. Yes.
His Excellency Signor Napoleone is now leaving his room.
He's coming. He's coming. Quick. Give me a flower.
A flower.
Remember, at all times you must be above him, before him. Entering or leaving, you must be first. Hello, Hinky! Be good, be good! How do you feel?
Wait a minute, wait a minute.
Ah, my brother dictate. You're a nice little man, Hinky. I'm so glad to see you again.
And it's interesting because, you know, he was interviewed about this, Chaplin was, and he said, like, if I had known that things were as bad as they were, I never would have made this movie. Because it's hard to joke about when you find out what's being done in the concentration camps. You're like, because they had no idea the extent. Because at this point, when this movie was being filmed, we were still at peace during World War II. Like, we hadn't entered the fray yet. So it does, you know, so maybe he felt a little bit more freedom to, like, take the piss out of these guys. Because, like, you didn't really know how murderous and how – you didn't know about the experimentation and the death camps and all this stuff. It's probably harder to go after them when you find out about the stuff. Because, like, how do I joke about this in a way that's not disrespectful? But I'm so glad he did, because this is, like, the great – maybe the greatest takedown of an evil man in the history of film. Like, this is just phenomenally done. Like, just – it's just the right amount, because they don't make him out to be a complete buffoon, but enough that you're like, oh, this guy, I can't wait for him to get his, because they play it like he's an idiot. Right. And he doesn't really have the power that he thinks he is. I like that he's shorter than just about everybody in this movie. And he's constantly kind of pushed around, especially by the Mussolini character. Like, that stuff is fantastic.
But that's such a hard balance to manage as well, like presenting a dictator as an idiot, because they're clearly not lacking some kind of methodical mindset that got them to where they are. They have a mentality that is driven by hate, driven by fear, and driven by xenophobia and anti-Semitism and things like that. And that doesn't come from a mind that basically is stupid or dumb. But Chaplin manages to make Hinkle quite a dumb, pathetic person. And mm-hmm. I think that I don't love this film as much as everybody else does. I felt for the most part that I felt that the balance of trying to get the balance of understanding the present moment was there. But then because we have so much history, because we have so much understanding of what happened in World War II, it's really hard to marry up the horror of what was to come with what's actually in the film. And a lot of that is done in those last 5 minutes with that speech. A lot of that is kind of, you know.
So good.
Yeah. And that's a masterpiece moment. It's a brilliant moment, right? But everything leading up to that feels a little bit jokey in a manner that kind of undercuts everything just a little bit. And I thought that for the most part that, you know, he's presenting some kind of normalcy as a way of like, this is what we're fighting for. You know, this, you know, being able to muck around and have some fun in a barbershop and, you know, spending time with friends and things like that is what we're fighting for, right? I understand that. Mm-hmm. But on the same hand, this film is so long that when it gets to those kinds of final moments, it feels like it just kind of dusts its hands off. And I wish that Chaplin had maybe taken an extra 10 minutes after that speech to show us the fallout of what happened. I know this is a fantasy, but effectively what happens is that, you know, this private officer manages to find himself in the place of Hinkle and, you know, delivers this powerful speech, and then all of a sudden the war is off and it's all done and dusted. And, you know, it feels nice and pat because it is nice and pat, but I just wish that I'd seen just a little bit more after that, just to see, because it feels like everything's just gone back to normal when it clearly wouldn't have, because the threat and the violence is still there from the people who believe this one person. We see so many people, you know, there are multiple dictators in this film, and it feels like a comedy show, because it is a comedy show, of course, but it's a comedy show grounded in seriousness. And you know, I can't help but think of something like Vice, which almost works in the same kind of level. Like, there is a level of truth to Vice, of course, because it is based on reality. But Adam McKay pulls from the same kind of strains as Charlie Chaplin does, where he's trying to make these real figures farcical and for us to laugh at them. And we're supposed to laugh at George Bush. We're supposed to laugh at Dick Cheney. And we do, because, you know, the performances, I thought, in that particular film were pretty funny. But it's hard to separate the reality there and the seriousness of what's happening and the seriousness of what these people are fighting for. Did you find that at all yourself? Or, you know,
let me speak to that. So, one, I think one of the things you're talking about is just how hard satire is to do. You know, there's a really difficult balance, and it's not going to work for everybody. It is jokey. It's designed to be. And I also think you have to try to remember to put this in the context of when this movie came out. It's very easy for us to look back and, like, we know the awful things that were done because people believed in Adolf Hitler. But this was maybe the first time, especially in American history, that we had seen people follow someone this evil without question. So I think this movie, I think if you had this same speech now, like if this was never written and you made a satire about another world leader, say one with an orange hue, and you put this in there, I think people might roll their eyes, because now we know. We know what has been done because, you know, people are brought along by a charismatic leader. But, like, I'm actually, like, looking at the speech right now. And, like, it's one of the few speeches in film that has, like, brought me to tears. Like, I was watching this, and, like, it's so impactful. Like, this one little bit of it I really like. He's talking about how, you know, our greed has poisoned us. And he says, our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and will be lost. And this is, like, lines like this, it's like, wow. Like, it just makes you really think about how impactful films can be. Because that could not be more true about how we spend our time building these machines that are originally designed to bring us closer, and they actually end up pulling us apart. And that is true now just as well as it was back then. And especially given the fact that we did not, when this movie was made, did not realize the extent of the horrific damage that was being done to humanity by Adolf Hitler and by all of his followers. I think I can forgive the movie for not understanding that. The other thing to bring up really is that I'm glad there wasn't anything after this. I'm glad there wasn't 10 or 15 minutes more, because I think it waters down the message. Like, this is a message movie, even though it's a comedy. This is the entire movie is building up to this speech. It feels very much to me like he wrote this amazing piece and was like, all right, now I got to build a movie to get here. I got to find a way to get to this, you know? So I think if you continue this after this and you kind of show the impact of it, I think it like lessens the impact. This is a rousing speech to leave your audience with. This is what he wants people to learn about the world around them, because the only thing that stops evil dictators isn't necessarily armies, right? It isn't the firepower. You need that in a situation like this. But the reason that firepower was eventually brought along is that there was outrage and people saw what was going on and they knew it was evil and they stood up and told their leaders that we need to do something about this. We can't just sit and let this happen. And this is what he's talking about, is that, you know, we can't be just victims of the system. We have to like stand up and be heard. And it's so powerful. As I was watching this, like, I couldn't help but think of now, to think of everything that's gone on, especially in the United States in the last, you know, 4 to 8 years, and be like, and that's essentially what happened here, is that people saw evil and they stood up and they rioted in the streets because this is wrong. Right? Is who we have, is the system we have solved? Absolutely not. Are cops still killing unarmed black people? Yes. Do we still have politicians who are doing terrible things? Absolutely we do. But we cleared one hurdle, right? And it is a lifelong effort. I do not think that on the day I die, things will be solved.
No.
They won't. And you have to be okay with that. You have to be able to stand up in the moment and say, what I'm seeing right now is wrong and we need to do better and we need to be more human and we need more connection. So for this to be, I mean, it's a little depressing to watch this and realize how much it applies now, all these decades later. You know, like, this is what, 1940? It is 2020 now. So, you know, 81 years later. And it's still like, yeah, we still need that. We're still cynical. We still need to be drawn together by our humanity. You know, and it's sickeningly enough, you brought up fucking Paddington 2 and, like, you know, this whole, like, be kind and nice and the world will be right or whatever it is. Like, that's, I mean, this is saying the same thing.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Is that we need to be kind. We need to feel. We need to care for our brothers and sisters out there in the world, regardless of color or creed. We have to care that people are dying and people are suffering. And if we don't, then we're all going to suffer if we don't reach out and help one another.
I think that's really important to carry on to with this particular film, because, you know, one of the most notable aspects is that Chaplin knew what the power of the podium was, because he both saw it in Hitler, but he also knew what the power of cinema is. You know, it is a direct means to be able to get a message out to people. It is a direct means to be able to influence people. And I guess there is no film, you know, more that typifies what it means to be an influence on people and to inform and to change people's minds than something like The Great Dictator. It is a pure empathy machine. It is a pure understanding of what happens. And I think that one of the genius things that Chaplin did was portraying both the villain and the hero in this particular film, because it shows how close they are together and how close they are as two human beings, and the line between being, you know, a terrible, not saying that we all have a dictator hiding inside ourselves, that's not what I'm trying to say, but, you know, the line between being an awful, heinous, terrible human being and being somebody who is nice and empathetic and caring for other people is pretty close. You know, it is pretty close, and it's on us to ensure that we stay on the right side of that. And I think that one of the powerful things about The Great Dictator is that, you know, Chaplin as a filmmaker, saw what was coming and knew that the only way that he could be able to do stuff was to make a film about it. And, you know, I'm sure that he did other things as well, but, you know, effectively showing what the rise of fascism and, you know, having a group of people fighting against that in a film is probably one of the most effective things that he could have done as a filmmaker, to be able to say what is coming is terrible, heinous, and we must do something about it. And that in itself makes this a very important film. It really does.
Right.
And it, in a manner, it kind of feels like when I logged it on Letterboxd, I was like, you know, it's a film like The Great Dictator where you sit there and go, yeah, this whole rating system feels trite.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, it's so important and impactful that you're like, oh, well, 4 stars or 5 stars. Like,
exactly.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Like, it's just, and I'm glad you brought up this idea of how close these two characters are. I was just reading, there was a memoir called My Father, Charlie Chaplin, that his son wrote. And he wrote, their destinies were poles apart, speaking of Chaplin and Hitler. One was to make millions weep while the other was to set the whole world laughing. Dad would never think of Hitler without a shudder, half of horror, half of fascination. Just think, he would say uneasily, he's the madman, I'm the comic, but it could have been the other way around. Like, it's like, you know, they were, I guess they had like really similar backgrounds. They were born like 4 days apart. Like, you know, it's just like where you were, where you lived, where you were raised, who was around you has an impact. Because like, obviously, Hitler, one of the most evil men, people in history. There's no arguing that fact. But he was also a part of Germany, who after the First World War was utterly decimated. Like, no one had any money. No one could survive. The country was lower than dirt. So he comes along and allows them to blame someone else. And it's a human reaction. It's not a human reaction to take that blame and start concentration camps and do medical experiments on people. But the idea of a scapegoat, there's a reason a scapegoat is a literary feature of every country, every artist, every time in human history, because it's easier than taking a look at the complexity of everything around us. So, you know, there's a reason this stuff was so easy to happen, just like in the United States. You know, people talk about, you know, racism and economic inequality being two of the big reasons that Trump came to power, right? It's easier if you can blame someone else and you can look back on a past that was so great, even though none of us were around to see it. And the past was only great if you were male and white. Who cares about any of that? But like, if you have an easy someone or something to blame, then people go along with it because people are scared, people are angry, people are poor, people are struggling, and we want someone to blame. And it really does, as you mentioned rightly, go to the power of the spoken word. But it's a film like this is so great because it brings hope, right? Because the idea of this is if you have someone else in that same spot to say the right thing at the right time, you could change the hearts and minds of millions, right? He talks about, you know, the telephone and the radio bringing us all closer together. And that's the reason so many of you can hear my voice right now. And to me, that's Chaplin talking about the movies, right? The reason you're all listening to me is because I'm an actor and I'm a director and I have access to you because of all this technology. And I'm going to use that to tell you that we are all humans and we should all be together and we should all be banding together instead of fighting one another.
Humor heightens our survival and preserves our sanity. These are the words of Charlie Chaplin. So are these, written over 30 years ago. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without those qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. Humor and humanity, the abiding elements of Chaplin's artistic conscience and his unparalleled talent as actor, writer, director, producer, composer, and to quote W.C. Fields, the greatest ballet dancer that ever lived. Chaplin has become more than a name. It is a word in the vocabulary of films. And anyone who has ever seen a movie is in his debt. A few years ago, Mr. Chaplin said, "My only enemy is time." We respectfully disagree. For wherever and whenever there is communication, a screen and an audience, whether here on Earth and now, or in some unfathomable future on some faraway star, time is Charlie Chaplin's dearest and eternal friend.
And what an amazing, powerful, wonderful message for Chaplin to give to all these people. I mean, this was the second highest grossing film of that year. So many people heard this. So many people took this to heart. And it's like that, I mean, not to be like too dramatic about it, but this is why, stuff like this is why I love movies, right? That someone you've never met, someone who's been dead for decades, you can watch a movie and be not only emotionally impacted, but impacted in a way where you start thinking about the choices that you're making in your own life and in the world around you. That something filmed in like 1938, in 2021, you can be like, oh man, I really need to think about the choices I'm making and what I'm putting out in the world and my attitude towards people less fortunate than me. Like I, you know, if you honestly, like if you are a person who didn't give a shit about Black Lives Matter and you listen to the speech, I don't know how you can't connect these two. I don't know how you can't connect the idea of bonding together as people and treating everyone as human and with kindness and with empathy. I don't know how you can't take that from this movie. And it's like, honestly, I could have despised the rest of the movie. And if it has this speech, this is at least a 3 or 4 star movie just on the strength of that last 10 minutes. Like all the other stuff is great and it's funny and it's wonderful. But like, this is up there with like the best speeches ever to be recorded on film. Like I'd have to seriously think about it to think about better moments of monologue on screen. Like this is just tremendous.
Yeah, yeah. It lost the Oscar to The Great McGinty by Preston Sturges, by the way, just out of for Best Original Screenplay. Like, we're all Jesus remembering Christ. That particular film.
The Great what?
But yeah, look, it is powerful in a lot of ways. I think I find it hard to... I need to revisit this down the line because I found myself really conflicted watching this particular film. I thought it was really powerful, really important and brilliant. Mm-hmm. I also felt it was a little bit overlong. But it was also hard to shake the shadow of stuff like... I mean, we talk about Mel Brooks and he won an Oscar for The Producers, writing the screenplay for that. So, you know, there is a manner and an ability to marry comedy with Hitler and it be very successful, both creatively and, you know, financially, of course. But then you have somebody like, you know, Roberto Benigni, who decades and decades later would eventually win an Oscar for acting and, you know, having been nominated for Best Picture as well, for Life is Beautiful, where, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen that film, but my memory of it is that he tries to blend the comedy of something like The Great Dictator, and not to the same level that Chaplin does, but he tries to blend...
But, like, in the midst of, like, actual concentration camp.
Exactly. Like,
this is yeah. the difference. Where
Chaplin, he's literally clowning around.
Going on. And this is like, oh, God. Yeah, Life is Beautiful is that's a rough one. Like, it's one of those where, like, you see what he was going for. But there's some stuff in there where I'm like, that is in poor taste. Whereas this, with the context, I'm like, okay, you know, I get it. And I think it's also interesting that he got the idea to make this film after watching Triumph of the Will, which is maybe the most famous propaganda film of all time, directed by Riefenstahl. And I guess a bunch of other directors saw it and they were like so horrified. Mm. And Chaplin watched it and just thought it was the funniest shit he'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, this fucking jackass, I can do this. Watch this. And then he wrote The Great Dictator. So there's that. And I'd much rather watch this than Triumph of the Will. I'm not putting myself through that.
No, look, I mean, yeah, I've seen Triumph of the Will a long time ago. And, you know, look, I do cringe when people who are like, I'm going to watch 50 films directed by women this year and then Triumph of the Will happens to be one of them. It's like, no, you had a choice.
No, don't do that. So many options. Don't do that. It's like, well, I want to watch movies about race. Like, okay, let's watch D.W. Griffith movies. Like, no, there's better options. Yeah. You don't need to do that. Let's walk away.
Exactly. Yeah. But with Life is Beautiful, like, obviously it's not Triumph of the Will, but on the same hand, there is a, it just highlights how difficult and impossible it can be to blend comedy with extreme horror and extreme violence and extreme real violence and terror. And I know that there is criticism as well directed at Benigni for that particular film because he wasn't Jewish. And I'm not sure if Chaplin was Jewish or not, but, you know, at least he delivers The Great Dictator in a respectful manner, in a manner that feels inclusive. And it feels like, you know, we are embracing everybody at once. And that's the important thing. I think this is a really good film. It is obviously an important film. I am so glad that Rebecca won Best Picture, but, you know, I can't see... I can see the different future that we would have had if something like The Great Dictator would have won. Because while Rebecca is a great film, as has so often been shown throughout Oscar history, they do enjoy message films. And this is probably one of the most prime message films around. As we've talked about multiple times, that particular speech is just downright important. Like, it's important in itself. I kind of wish that that had won because of that particular, the meaning behind it and the importance behind it. But, you know, on the same hand, I would have been disappointed if Rebecca had lost, because it's great. It's a must.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're honestly, like, to me, they're both 5-star films. So, like, I would be fine with either one. And I just feel like it's interesting, the idea of a message film, because a lot of times I cringe at message films, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh God, it's so heavy-handed. And this is heavy-handed, of course. Like, it's like a 10-minute speech at the end about what we should do with our lives and how we should function in the world and getting closer together and having empathy. But it works. It's just so well written and so engaging. So it's like, I think the fact that it spends the entire movie building up to that. Like, the rest of it's comedy, and there's like little moments of, like, you know, especially within the ghetto, with the barber and the female lead, there's moments of like, wow, this is really messed up, what's going on here. But he saves all of the pontificating for this one moment. And it's also a brilliant showing of, like, you know, right place, right time. You know, you get, you know, that character had every chance to, like, not speak or speak vaguely about things. But instead, he took this opportunity to do the right thing. And it's kind of a lesson in, like, for all of us, that we all have the opportunity to speak. We all have a voice. We all, and like he said, and all the technology, we have the ability to talk to people around the world and to say what we think and what we feel and what we believe. And we have to do that. Like, there's no time like the present, and there's no time more important than now to talk about these things.
But I think one of the important things as well is that for Chaplin's main character, he, and as it's been shown with Rebecca and The Great Dictator, it kind of doesn't matter what the characters' names are, because it's clear that they don't care to name them themselves, but it's okay. But he is clearly somebody who is self-reflecting throughout the whole entire film. And we see him self-reflect throughout the whole entire film. We see him sit there and go, what about this and what about that? And it makes sense then that when he is thrust into a moment of action, that he has to say all this stuff, because it's literally everything that has been building up this brick wall in his mind. And it's hard to escape. And I think that's really an important thing that, you know, it sounds so trite and silly to say, oh, you must think about yourself, or you must have some self-reflection, or you must, because it seems like something that everybody should do, or everybody should already be doing. But
not everybody does.
Not everybody does, you know, and I think that's, it is worthwhile repeating that we need to look at ourselves and go, okay, how did I end up in this moment? And especially, you know, if we're talking about things like Black Lives Matter and stuff like that, we're two white guys. You know, one of the key things is, you know, in Australia as well, like, we have major issues with the government and the treatment of Indigenous people in Australia. and they are treated terribly. And yet one of the things that continually happens is we have white people injecting ourselves into conversations because we think we know best. One of the important things is to have a little bit of self-reflection and go, geez, maybe my voice isn't needed right now. Maybe I need to step back and not say something. And I think that this particular film just reinforces that. It is going to be a timeless film. You know, I don't know what the state of cinema is going to be like in 100 years' time. But I imagine that just like the works of Shakespeare, something like The Great Dictator, even if it's just this speech, remains, will still be important, will still carry weight and still carry value. And that in itself is, it's a sign of a great work of art. It's a sign of, you know, something that is better or more important than just being a film, you know, than just being entertainment. And that in itself is, it's inescapable. It's, again, why we watch films. It's why we do these kinds of things. And it's why, you know, it's why I enjoy going through and watching these particular Best Picture nominees and winners, because we touch on these kinds of films every so often, and it reminds that there is a little bit of importance to these kinds of things, even though, you know, there's a lot of shit films that have won or that have been nominated. There is an importance to the ones that were nominated, and we deserve to remember them and recall them. And, you know, not just because they were nominated for Best Picture. There's so many great films that weren't nominated, of course, as we've said time and time again. But this label elevates it just that little bit more. So, yeah, it's important. It matters.
Yeah. I think if you're comparing it to Shakespeare and saying that people are going to be listening to this in 100 years, I think it's fair to say it matters, I think. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with everything you just said. Absolutely.
So, yeah. I guess, do you have anything else you want to add about this besides the fact that you are now a changed person? The person
I think, I think the only thing to add is that Andrew's a terrible person because he was like, it's okay. I guess
I gave
it's
it
fine.
3.5 stars.
Oh, God, you're killing me. But you're right. I mean, you know, you kind of talked about like rating a film like this feels very silly.
It feels
like
it redundant.
Just feels so. Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And like, you know, I guess when it comes to rating films on Letterboxd, like, I do it because, you know, it is nice to kind of go, this is how I felt in the moment. This is how I felt when I watched the particular film. But, you know, our emotions change of films as we go along. And our emotions, our memories change of it because they become part of us, you know. And especially, it's even more important with a film like The Great Dictator, where it literally does, that speech will ring in our heads for so long because it does become part of us. It does become part of who we are. And it becomes, if the film has done its job properly, then it will inform you and encourage you to be a better person. And I think that's what matters. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. So what are we talking about next time? We're talking about Citizen Kane, right? That's what won that year, right?
What's Citizen Kane? No, we're going to watch Mank instead. No.
I mean, don't tempt me. I will. I'll do it.
How green was my valley? Well, how green was my valley?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to find out, Andrew.
Actually, it's more of a statement, isn't it? It's a statement. How
it
green
is.
Was my valley?
It is a statement.
Yeah.
Yep. Just one more fucking John Ford movie. Here we go.
I've never seen this one. I am looking forward to it. The next year is quite a stacked year, and it's, you know, yes, of course, Citizen Kane lost Best Picture. Good-o. These things happen. We are not going to be doing an episode on Citizen Kane because you already know it's an important film. You already know it's great.
Right.
I'm going to rewatch it, of course, because why not? It's Citizen Kane. But, you know, you don't need to hear us talking about it. I'm sure that Dave's talked about it in the past sometime.
Probably. I mean, I think it's maybe the most, it's got to be like in terms, especially in terms of film podcasts, like maybe the most talked about movie ever.
Like, it's just like, you know, it's known as one of the like five best movies ever made by pretty much everybody. So like, what am I going to say that's new about Citizen Kane? Like, you know, let's move on to something else. So we're going to do How Green Was My Valley. What was our bonus episode for this year? Have we decided?
We did.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Fantastic. We get to talk about Suspicion. That makes me happy. Yeah. So that'll be, our two episodes coming up. How Green Was My Valley and Suspicion. Fuck Citizen Kane. No one cares about that movie.
No. And I'm really glad about this year as well, because it's finally forcing me to watch things like The Maltese Falcon, which I've never seen. So, you know, I get to watch another good film. Apparently it's a good film. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, that will be on our next episode of Awards Don't Matter. Awards Don't Pod on Twitter. Dave, where can people find you as well?
Just follow me at Darn That Dave, and you can find my, you know, 19 podcasts on there, and I'll post some links so you can hear more of me if you want to.
Have you spawned any new podcasts since we last just talked?
There's one in planning stages, so we'll see. There's always another one. Yep. Always, always, always.
Yep. Okay, cool. No worries. All right, well, we'll see you on the next episode, and yeah, take care.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!